Jahars and I have sat expressionless and nearly motionless next to his attorneys today. He's done that just about every day of this trial. But listening to his defense team today, you wouldn't know he was even in the room or the one on trial. On day 24, the second day of defense testimony in the penalty phase of the trial, it was all about Tamerlan, Jahars' older, now dead brother. As Jahars' defense team continued to build the case that the jury sentenced him to life in prison over the death penalty. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
And Kevin, at 3:50 this afternoon, I snap to attention. They're 10 minutes before court ends for the day. And on the stand, the son of Tsarnaev family landlord over in Cambridge on Norfolk Street was talking about Jahar. Sweet kid, he says. Very sweet kid. Cheerful. It was the first time all day that any of the witnesses talked about Jahar directly. It lasts for 3 minutes, and then the defense attorney, Miriam Conrad, asked the witness, what about Tamerlan? What about Tamerlan?
At this point, at the way this is going, we're going to have to exhume Tamerlan's body so he can be executed in place of his brother, because this is clearly what the defense is trying to do. And the prosecution is growing increasingly frustrated over this, and they've been treating these witnesses that the defense has put up with almost scorn and just pointing out that, do you know the defendant? Have you ever met the defendant? Do you know anything about the defendant?
There's some fascinating stuff that came out today. A number of witnesses who, as you say, either minimally know Jahar or not at all, they're talking about Tamerlan, and I thought there were some particularly telling portraits. For instance, the boxing coach talks about meeting Tamerlan. Do you remember that?
Who's this, Johnny Curran?
Yeah, Johnny Curran. He starts off by saying, Tamerlan, my first memory is that he was kind of charming. He was completely eager to participate. My problem with him was that he didn't listen to coaching instructions.
Yeah, Cameron was upset that Tamerlan had learned to box in Russia, and he boxed with a European style, which is very straight up. It affects your ability to throw a hook. And so he was trying to get him to adopt the American style, which is to bend at the knees, crouch down a little bit, and it changes where you throw the punches from, where you actually defend punches from. And Cameron said he just wouldn't do that. He just was not a cooperative person.
Kevin, I thought that is the insight into the entire story here. He couldn't adjust to America. He couldn't learn the American style.
He couldn't even bend at the knees.
That's it. Could not and would not. And so you have a kid who wants to be a boxer. He's having success because Curran says he has a lot of ability. And there's the photograph that I found absolutely shocking.
The headgear?
The headgear, because there he is with his coach and his father, and he's in red, white, and blue. The flag is his headgear.
Right.
I looked at that, and it's assaulting after what we know about him and what he did.
Well, also, evidence came out, testimony emerged, that Tamerlan was very talented as an amateur and that he had twice won the Golden Gloves competition up in Lowell, Mass., which is a very famous amateur boxing competition. And when you win the Lowell Golden Gloves for your weight class, you are automatically qualified to go to the Nationals. Now, when Tamerlan won it in 2009, he went out to Salt Lake City, but he was actually very ill. He fought one fight and really just was completely exhausted and lost. The next year, he won it in 2010 again up in Lowell for the heavyweight class, but he was not allowed to go to the Nationals because in the interim, USA Boxing, whose headgear with the red, white, and blue he had worn, had enforced a rule that no foreign nationals could box in the Nationals during an Olympic year. So this was crushing to Tamerlan. It was very interesting that the witness said he took it personally.
The next witness,
this was all about him.
One of the later witnesses said that. I tracked down Johnny Curran after he testified, and I said, you have to tell me about that headgear. Did he choose that headgear? And he said, when I saw this picture and I realized later, in retrospect, it made me sick. He said, the reason it was red, white, and blue, the American flag, it was the only one that fit. And then he went on to tell me, you know, Tamerlan was a coward, because Tamerlan's a big guy.
Yeah.
But when he saw boxers that were smaller than him, he got all puffed up. He backed off the other ones. And then Curran looks at me and he says, you know, he was the cowardly lion. And that kid in there, meaning Jahar, he's the tin man. No hot, no hot.
You know, it's the beginning of this overweening sense of grievance that Tamblyn, and we're talking about beginning in 2010 when he couldn't go to the Nationals. And then 3 years later, he's walking down Boyle Street with his brother and they both have bombs. So it's a 3 year period that he goes from this guy, you know, who had the dream of boxing for the United States in the Olympics. Whether that was realistic, we'll never know. The fact is he went in 3 years from having that dream to deciding to attack Americans, to attack something as iconic and as American as the Boston Marathon.
And even the coach, Johnny Curran, said a lot and a little. He'd only seen Jahar twice. And he said when he saw them, what he noticed was that Jahar was following Tamblyn like a puppy.
Like a puppy, yeah.
And that for the defense.
I love that. That is the defense. They want you to believe that he followed him like a puppy right down Boylston Street. Just this time, the puppy happened to have a pressure cooker bomb in a backpack.
Now, we go to learning more about Tamblyn. Mark Spencer, he has been here before. He testified for the defense in the first phase of the trial. He's a digital forensic consultant. I thought there was some pretty powerful stuff in what he had to say.
Absolutely. They built up this idea of Tamblyn being absolutely obsessed with violence, particularly with when it came to the killing and suffering and abuse that Muslims face in different parts of the world. The images that flashed from that hard drive, we saw pictures of Palestinians, we saw pictures of Syrians, we saw pictures of Muslims all over the world, and there was just this sort of grotesque collection of dead bodies, many of them young children. And so this is the stuff that Tamblyn feasted on constantly.
And what the witness was able to establish is that it is Tamblyn who is collecting these images and storing them in files. And then he's sending them.
Sharing them.
He's sharing them with his wife and with Jahar. And he's doing it even while he's in Russia, sending these images. What I think might be very powerful about this is it's an alternative reality, because the jurors here have seen image after image, video after video of the most horrifying, gory, bloody, horrific scenes in Boston. And now they're looking at other scenes of people who've been maimed, of children who have been maimed, you know, the counterparts of Martin Richard in age in some cases.
I thought it was really interesting, David, that the defense has gone out of its way to point almost a finger at Catherine, the wife. I mean, if you sat through the defense case the last 2 days, you'd have two questions. Is Tamblyn on trial? And why isn't his wife? I mean, the stuff that was showed today that was on her computer, the MacBook that she had, right before Tamblyn left for Russia and right after he left for Russia, in that period, she was doing these searches, internet searches. One of was, if your husband becomes a shaheed, a martyr, what are the rewards for you? And, you know, she searched for the wife of a mujahideen. She was interested in this.
Which is a fighter.
Somebody who wages jihad. So that suggests she had prior knowledge to what her husband was up to in January of 2012 when he left for Russia, presumably or actually allegedly, to hook up with jihadis. So she knew about this stuff, which begs the question, one, why has she not been a witness? Two, would she get on the stand and take the Fifth Amendment?
No, she has been thoroughly investigated. We know this. There's been a grand jury. We know this. She did not testify and wasn't called to the grand jury, according to her attorney. But, of course, you don't call the target to the grand jury. This is a very good question, and people point and correctly point to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Why haven't they done anything? They have made a decision at this point not to come forward with charges. Maybe it will.
I think this goes back to the tension. We've talked about it earlier, about what the Bureau wanted and what the U.S. Attorney was prepared to do. I have no doubts. I've talked to people in the FBI that they were much more aggressive on the friends in college who destroyed evidence or moved evidence, and they were also much more aggressive on Catherine Sarneva, that they were much more in favor of pursuing her very aggressively. So there is a divide there.
There is a question, and the question is, to what extent is she culpable?
Right.
Remember, she's working long, long days, and she even has the baby with her while her husband is not working.
Right.
He's cruising the internet. She may not have any idea what he was doing while she was off. And then you look at the house, okay, you might say, hey, why does she think there are the BBs there? Why does she think the stuff in the house, maybe...
About those Christmas lights.
The Christmas lights, yeah. I mean, it's not exactly that they're celebrating the birth of Jesus. You know,
yes.
It's not, that's not happening here. So one of the questions in the end is, what do you get by prosecuting her? Is there anything that she could give up? Good questions.
Right.
Tamerlan has on his computer a sticky note on his desktop. Quranic verses. Allah will punish them through your hands, will belittle them and grant you a victory over them, and will heal the breast of the believers. There's a lot of this stuff that's on his computer. And, you know, you were talking about, I mean, how much stuff
yes,
they were bringing. It was Tamerlan, Tamerlan, Tamerlan. I thought of the second book of the Iliad, where you have the catalog of the ships, of all the ships that the Achaeans took to go to Troy, and there were 1,000 ships. It was like Bill Fick just calling up the documents, cataloging all this stuff that was on Tamerlan's computer.
What the defense wants to show is, in comparison, is that Jahar was still looking up stupid stuff on his Facebook. He was doing on his computer what they say the ordinary 19-year-old American kid was looking at, whereas Tamerlan is obviously obsessed with death, destruction, and incredible grievance.
At some point, they got to turn the corner to, okay, that's Tamerlan. Here is Jahar. Here's how he's responding. Here's how
and
he's
And we saw a
it.
Glimpse today, you know, Sam Lipson, whose mother owned the place where they lived, and he talked about Jahar as a little boy. That's what the defense
sweet
wants
kid.
The jury to hear. Not only that he was a little boy, that he was a sweet kid. And the contrast that is that Tamerlan was not sweet.
So on notes of sweetness and puppies,
light.
That's how we end this, and it's not a bad way for the defense to end it. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again tomorrow as testimony for the defense continues.
Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.